So we're up to part three of the series, Trick, Loopholes, and Legal Fictions. Does Halacha allow us to deceive God? And again, for after the first session when we introduced the vocabulary, so what we're doing each week is look at another device or another instance where it looks like we're trying to pull a fast one on the Halacha, or by extension, pull a fast one on God. So last week we did the Pruzbul, and we saw Hillel's creation of a legal fiction. And essentially what we saw was the Mishnah had said that Hillel created the Pruzbul for the purpose of Tikkun Olam, which we said means great societal need. And the conditions that we said was that he's working within the system, he's not working outside of the system, and he's working in the moment of extreme need, and so forth, right? Those are like two important conditions within our discussion. Now, tonight, so I had mentioned, I think, at the beginning, that we're going to do a bunch of case studies, and one that belonged to the ancient world, one that belongs to the medieval world, and one that belongs in modern times. So Hillel is the example of ancient times, right? He's living during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, and this week we're going to turn to medieval or kind of early modern. We're going to look at the threshold between the Middle Ages and modernity, and that's where the question of the sale of chametz comes up. Now, the sale of chametz, unlike the Pruzbul, which some people, in fact a number of people, had never even heard of before, the sale of chametz is something that we all do, right? Every one of us, in some form or another, sells our chametz when Pesach comes. And every year, people who have been selling their chametz probably for decades, when they sell the chametz to me, always say, oh, is this for real? Ha ha, very funny, la la, etc., etc. And every year I assure them that it is a very, very real sale, and that it's a binding sale, and that should the non-Jew to whom we sell the chametz show up in your house at any point on Pesach and say, let me into your liquor cabinet, they can make off, in theory, with hundreds of dollars of whiskey. You can't say boo to them. It all sounds like it's in theory, right? But do they know where you live? Do they have a key to your house? Are they ever going to come? And if not, is this all just another example of a legal fiction? Well, that's the big discussion centering around the sale of chametz. And the question is, how do we get to the point where we sell our chametz essentially by writing our names and our addresses and a few details on a piece of paper, handing it over to the rabbi, who then in turn sells it to somebody so that there's no contact really between the people, most of the people, the vast overwhelming majority of the people who sell chametz and the person who's buying it. You probably don't know who the person who buys it is, and they probably don't know who you are, and so the question is that really a good legally binding sale? That's going to be the subject of tonight's discussion. And really what we're going to try to do is try to figure out, again, like I said, how we got to that point. How did it happen that we create a sale of that nature? Now, I want to just give you one just one thing that you should know for the purposes of full disclosure, which is that for the structure and for a lot of the discussion of this evening, I relied very much on a book called Hamoadim Bahalacha, which is written by Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin. I think, you know, I always say it's important to know like who the great people, especially the lesser known ones, like these great people who lived in previous generations. Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin, he died in the 70s, and in the 70s he was already, I think he was in his 90s when he died in the 1970s. He was this great Talmud Chacham, but most importantly, he was a very prolific author, and he wrote books on interesting topics before it might have been fashionable to do so. His books are pretty well known. He wrote a book, a collection of Hasidic tales that, I mean, when it was like, I think one of the early books that Art Scroll translated and published. When I was a kid, I remember reading the English Art Scroll translation of Rabbi Zevin's Hasidic tales. He like organized them according to the Parsha and the holidays, and that's one book that he wrote. And then he wrote a series of books that deal with more halachic and more practical topics. He wrote a book called L'Or HaHalacha, which means literally by the light of halacha, or through the prism of halacha, however you want to put it, where he looks at, again, issues that were contemporary in the 50s and 60s when he wrote them originally. He wrote these essays looking at modern topics through the prism of halacha. And he wrote a book called Hamoadim Bahalacha. Hamoadim Bahalacha, he emphasizes in the introduction, is not just like a book of laws that pertain to the Moadim, that pertain to the holidays. He doesn't just go through, okay, then before Pesach, you eat you get the matzah ready. Then you clean your house, and this is the way you clean it. And then what he does is he looks at sort of the broad picture of how halacha speaks to different topics that pertain to the chagim. And he does it, again, not just by sort of throwing sources and ideas at you, but by often taking a historical perspective on things. And what he does with the sale of chametz is great. He breaks it down, and I think I relied a lot on this article for the structure and for sources, and then I was just, you know, Googling around looking for some sources, translations of sources, and I saw that virtually every shir that you'll find online that talks about the sale of chametz comes back to Rabbi Zevin, because he really structured this his essay very, very smartly, and it also helps for our purposes to give you a little bit of perspective on how this institution called the sale of chametz evolved. Because if you really want to look at the way the sale of chametz started, it's the very first source on your page. It really started as a traditional sale. This is the first Mishnah of the second chapter of Psachim. Of course, the early chapters of Psachim deal with chametz and getting ready for Pesach and the search for chametz, etc. And the second chapter starts with the time that you're allowed to eat. You know probably that on Erev Pesach, we break down the morning, right, into the when are you allowed to eat chametz, when do you have to start burning the chametz, what comes in between. All that is a result of discussions in the rabbinic literature, specifically in the Mishnah. And the first Mishnah in the second chapter of Psachim says, listen, as long as you're permitted to eat chametz, you could do whatever you want with the chametz as well. In other words, it's a regular time, a regular day, in which you could derive any sort of benefit from chametz. You could eat it, you could feed it to your animals, to domesticated animals, and to non-domesticated animals, and to chickens. You could sell it to a non-Jew. You could derive any sort of benefit from it that you want. Which means they used to use bran for moisturizer, so you could do that if you want. And you could use the chametz if you want to heat up your oven. Whatever kind of benefit you could think of that is possible to derive from chametz, whether it means eating it, whether it means sharing it with others, selling it for a profit, whatever it might be, you're allowed to do that during the morning of Erev Pesach until the time comes that you're no longer allowed to derive benefit from the chametz. The Mishnah says, "Avar zmano asur b'hanato." But once the time passes, we're not going to get into those details now, you're no longer permitted to derive any sort of benefit from the chametz. I gave you the whole Mishnah, we're not going to read the whole Mishnah now. What's important to us is that opening line of the Mishnah, where the Mishnah gives you a list of things that you're allowed to do with chametz during the time that you're allowed to eat it. As long as you're allowed to eat it, you could eat it, you could feed it to your animals, you could feed it to the birds, and you could sell it to a non-Jew, and it kind of lists that matter-of-factly, right? And if you think about it, it's talking about, think of the quantities that are under discussion in this Mishnah. There's a very good chance that the quantity of chametz that the Mishnah is discussing is the quantity of chametz that a person would eat. So you could eat your chametz, and that's one way of getting rid of it. You could feed your chametz to your cow or to your chicken, and that's another way of getting rid of it. You could sell it to a non-Jew, and that's another way of not just getting rid of it, but of using it in an appropriate way. In short, the Mishnah is talking about a traditional sale. You have some stuff, you have some merchandise, you want to move the merchandise, you sell the merchandise, conversation over. Traditional sale. So the question is, how do we get from that traditional sale to, again, these lists that we make today and the very much non-traditional sale of chametz in which we engage regularly? So Rabbi Zevin, in his essay that, like I said, to a certain extent we're not going to totally structure this year, but I think it's important to sort of to trace it the way that he traces it. He calls the essay, first of all, not just, you know, the laws of selling chametz, but he actually entitles the essay "The Development of the Sale of Chametz." The sale of chametz and its evolution and its development. Because what he does is he traces four phases in the development of the sale of chametz. Phase one is essentially what we just read in the Mishnah, which is that you have a small quantity of chametz and you sell the small quantity of chametz to a non-Jew so that the non-Jew can eat it, right? You have a couple of rolls, you have, you know, a couple of boxes of pasta, whatever it might be. Sell it, get it out of your house, finished. You used to have it, now they have it. Like I said, traditional sale. A traditional transaction that we're used to. That's sort of phase one, right? Usual sale. Phase two, he says, is still a traditional sale. You have it, you sell it, it's out of your house, conversation over. Except that there might be a stipulation that should you wish to do so, you could potentially buy it back after Pesach. In other words, in the Mishnah it just says you're selling it, finished. The second phase, Rabbi Zevin says, in the historical development of the sale of chametz was that a person was allowed to sell their chametz, let the non-Jew take it completely, but the Jew will stipulate, should I desire to do so, I leave open the option of buying it back after Pesach. And we're going to have to see what exactly that means. Even in the time of the rabbis, even in the time of the Mishnah, we're going to have to see what exactly the nature of that stipulation is, because the nature of that stipulation is going to impact the way that we view the sale of chametz in future generations as well. But that's phase two. sell it with a stipulation that buying it back is possible. Stage three is what he calls a formalistic sale. Formalistic already means that the chametz is not necessarily going anywhere. The chametz is staying put, and what's happening is a transaction between a Jew and a non-Jew in which the ownership of the chametz is transferred to the person who is not Jewish, while the chametz itself may remain in the house of the Jew. Now, we'll see, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but we'll see that they come up with all sorts of ways of doing that, including selling or renting the room in which the chametz is located. So we often like sell a bit of property to the non-Jew, or we sell the cabinet in which we keep the chametz to the non-Jew, or we rent that space to the non-Jew. But again, the important point is that in terms of the physical location of the chametz, it hasn't gone anywhere. It's not like those first two stages where you basically pick up a box of bread and say, here, this goes into your house now. Now it's saying this stays in my house, but we've contractually settled that it now belongs to you. That's stage three. And stage three is what he says, what transpired during stage three was that every Jew would handle that for themselves. It wasn't like everybody would go to the rabbi or the Beis Din or whatever it was and ask them to do it, or you know, whatever, the Chabad website, and ask them to handle that for you. Instead, what you would do is, you would get a contract, and you would settle that contract with the person who was not Jewish, and you would make the deal on your own. That was stage three. So again, we're already at a point where the sale is more a matter of a legal formality, and less a physical transfer of the merchandise. But everybody's handling it on their own. And then stage four is where we get to the way that we do it today, in which you give power of attorney to an agent, generally speaking the rabbi, and you let that agent settle the deal, conduct the transaction on your behalf. And so it's also a formalistic deal, right? Again, in terms of like the nature of the deal, no, the merchandise is not necessarily going anywhere. But, sorry. But instead of handling it on your own, you hand it over to the rabbi. The reason that he says, you know, that was done, Rabbi Zevin, is because there were too many wild cards when it was left in the hands of the people. They would do it too late, or they would forget about the contract altogether, or there were all kinds of stages that people might have skipped, or little details that people might have overlooked that were making the rabbis very, very nervous to think that there was something wrong with the sale as it was conducted by individuals. And therefore, the rabbi said, you know what, better to let the rabbis handle it so that we know the halacha, we could do the sale in the correct way. Because there are a lot of details and a lot of technicalities that are connected to the sale of chametz. So better to let the experts handle it, so that became stage four. Yeah, John.
Two questions. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's take John's question. Why would it not have been necessary to establish this a lot earlier? That will be answered during the course of the discussion.
Okay. The second question is, it seems potentially problematic that the fact that we have to involve a non-Jew in this process, because the fact that we're considering the loophole, it makes it sound sort of weird, perhaps, you know, even if there's any explanation that goes to the non-Jew where we say, well, we've got this, you know, rule that requires that we're not allowed to own it, and we'd like to participate in this sale. You know, it's certainly going to be a binding sale, but it allows us to not have to completely get rid of it or something along those lines. Does it not perhaps undermine that person's impression of our religion or our approach to our religion?
So that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, that's sort of a meta question that we could deal with. That's sort of like a question you throw in the end, right? It's not a question you throw in the beginning. But the answer is, perhaps, although part of the answer, and this is something that we will see as we go along, is that religious people understand that other religious people are weird. Sometimes, right? And like really sympathetic religious people understand that there's something unusual in every religion. So, listen, if you're a real anti-Semite, you'd be like, the Jews, of course, you know, their religion is all about, you know, these stupid legalisms and loopholes and trying to get around things. But if you're more sympathetic, and there's a good chance that the non-Jews who we involve in the sale of chametz are the ones who are more, let's say, sympathetic towards Jews as a group. So, number one is that they understand that it's a formality and that every religion has some element of formality to it. Like I said, we'll see this to a certain extent, not like explicitly as we go along, but you know, there will be reference as we go along to the people who are involved in the actual sale. The other thing is, you know, I mean, I'll just put this sort of in parentheses, I was going to mention this later on, but a lot of rabbis are very careful about the person to whom they sell the chametz, not only in terms of, you know, that person's general impression of Judaism, but in terms of that person's professional stature. In other words, there are a lot of rabbis who will only sell the chametz to somebody who understands like the details of the laws of sales, and you know, to an accountant, to an attorney, to people who also, I guess, understand the creativity involved sometimes in the legal elements of people's assets. Let's put it that way. And so, in that sense, you deal, you know, when you get somebody who really understands the way that the laws work and the way that sales work and the way that property ownership can potentially work on or off the books, well, again, people like that might be a little bit more sympathetic. I'll just put that out there. You don't see a lot. I mean, again, you see allusions to it, but not a lot of like sort of this really makes us all look very, very bad. And I think it's all usually because we're careful to choose somebody who will not who will be somewhat more sympathetic towards us than other people might be. Yeah.
This is a technical question, but when you actually sell the chametz, mm-hmm. does he sell it to the person he's selling it to? Does he sell each case individually, or does he sell it like one?
So let me say it this way. In our shul, we have, right, let's say, shy of 100 families. So if I was to do each case individually, it would take probably, you know, an hour and a half to, or let's say maybe an hour to sell it. There, if we were to sell each person's chametz individually.
An hour and a half each?
No. Total. Total. There are shuls out there that have like, you know, 600 families. That would take the entire Erev Pesach. So what we do is really, we transfer it in bulk, right? And often a lot of rabbis get together so that you transfer, like, you know, you could transfer 7 shuls worth of people at once. You can give the person who's buying the chametz sort of a file box full of those little contracts that we have people fill out before Pesach, and you say, these are all yours. But what that means is, you know, not only in theory, but in fact, technically, according to halacha, and presumably according to American law as well, they are theoretically at liberty to go through the box, pull out a contract at random, go into that person's house and demand their food. Again, that's not just a theory. That's an actual fact. That's the stipulation of the sale. It is there. So yeah, they get it all at once. They don't go through each and everything, right? They're not going to be like, oh, they have vodka, they have bourbon, they have scotch, they have noodles. I'll take the scotch. No noodles. Not interested, right? That doesn't usually happen. What does happen is you take the whole thing. You tell them you're free to go through these contracts and take whichever one you want. It happens, by the way. It does happen. I think we try to make a point of making sure that at some point during the year, at least one of the people in the box of documents gets a knock on their door and turns over some chametz to the person who purchased it. Yes, you are.
So if they go to that house and buys the chametz for $200, is the recipient benefiting them from the chametz at that point?
So, yes. Wait, which recipient?
Who owns the chametz?
The original, the seller, the Jew, who's selling the chametz. So they do, and that's why we do it before the time, we conduct the sale during the time that you're still allowed to derive benefit from the chametz, because if you would do it too late, the Jew would be benefiting from chametz at a time that they're not permitted to do so, and that would be problematic.
But there's no money transferred.
Money is transferred. There's a deposit that's given to the person who conducts the sale. There is a deposit on all of the chametz, and should after Pesach the non-Jew decide that he or she wants to keep the chametz, then they have to pay the balance. That is. By the way, that's going to be the when we talk about those latter two phases. By the way, those second two phases, when the sale is more of a formality and less of an actual transfer of merchandise, that's usually the way it happened. And we'll see why. Like I said, as we go along. But what usually happened was that we said, listen, you know, now it's Erev Pesach. We're going to sell you X number of dollars worth of chametz. Give me a deposit now. After Pesach, should we decide that you're going to continue with this way, then you'll pay off the rest. But for now, it's sort of an outstanding debt. Should we decide to purchase the chametz back from you after Pesach? Should you decide to sell it back to us after Pesach? Then we won't, you know, you won't be on the hook for paying off the remainder of that debt. But as of now, it's an outstanding debt that you have towards us.
Back the person gets a deposit.
Sorry?
So you give the person back the deposit?
Yeah.
And something else did? Does he get a fee?
They might get a gift. I don't know about a fee, but maybe, I guess it all depends on how much of a professional they are, right? An attorney or an accountant might charge you a fee for their time. But it's at least, we certainly, try to show our appreciation. Okay, but now that we've said that, okay, so now that we sort of have an idea of the stages of historical development of the sale of chametz, and the idea that there are a lot of sort of loose ends and questions, and see, Ben's not here tonight. So he's not here to know that a lot of those loose ends are not going to get tied up. But we will tie up some of the loose ends. Well, again, for our purposes, we're particularly focused on this question of the trickery. How much trickery is really involved here, and how much serious business is really involved here? That's our big question. Because obviously, again, our discussion is how much does halacha allow us to engage in tricks, and how much does halacha allow us to engage in quote-unquote legal fictions, like we saw last week with the Prusbul, and we said that the Prusbul works within the system. The sale of chametz, we're also going to see, does it work within the system, or is it another example of trying to get around things? Is it another example of a trick? Okay, so let's go on with what we have here, because we want to trace the development and see how did we get from that scenario described in the Mishnah, in which you're just simply selling a box of noodles or a bottle of whiskey to a non-Jew, to the situation with our contracts as we do today. That's going to take us to the second source. The second source is from a Tosefta. Tosefta is also a source written by the Tanaim. The Tanaim are the rabbis who wrote the Mishnah, so it's a source that is roughly contemporary to the Mishnah, but did not get included in the corpus of the Mishnah, roughly contemporary, I said. And the Tosefta has a description of another scenario in which it's not a precise sale of transferring the chametz one for one. It says the following. If a Jew and a non-Jew were traveling on a boat, right, so Pesach is coming, in other words, and the Jew doesn't have that much to do with his chametz. So a Jew and a non-Jew are traveling on a boat, the chametz b'yad Yisrael, and the Jew owns chametz, and now Pesach is coming. So what does he do? So the Mishnah, so the Tosefta says, he can sell that chametz to the Gentile, to the non-Jew, or he can give it to him as a gift. V'chozer, this is like the last few words of the that first line of Tosefta. V'chozer v'lokeach mimenu la'achar ha-Pesach. You can give it to him before Pesach, or sell it to him before Pesach, and then buy it back after Pesach. But here are the key words, these five words at the end of that line of the Tosefta. Again, this is like sort of that middle line of that source, are very, very key. The words are ubilvad shiitno lo b'matana gemura, which literally translates as long as the Jew gives it to him, gives the chametz to the non-Jew, b'matana gemura, as a total gift, as a bona fide, full-fledged gift or a full-fledged transfer of ownership. Okay, those words, ubilvad shiitno lo b'matana gemura, as long as you give it to him, for real, as long as the non-Jew really becomes the owner of this merchandise, that's going to be the subject of a big discussion and upon which our understanding of how you're allowed to sell chametz hinges. A lot of our discussion is going to hinge on how we interpret those words, what exactly those words mean. Just to continue, though, the Tosefta now continues and says, a Jew may say to a non-Jew, by the way, instead of just buying 100 whatever shekels worth of chametz, why don't you buy 200 shekels worth of chametz for me, and then maybe after Pesach I'll buy it back from you. So again, the Tosefta gives us, that line of the Tosefta is also up for debate as to what exactly it means, but at least according to some interpretations, what we have here is the Jew telling the non-Jew, buy more chametz from me than you really need, with the possibility that I will buy it back from you when the holiday is over. And this is sort of stage two in Rabbi Zevin's tracing of the history of the sale of chametz. In other words, we're still selling it to the non-Jew and transferring the property, the merchandise, completely into the possession of the non-Jew, but we have at least these indications or these stipulations that the possibility of buying it back is out there. Okay, so that's stage two. Your Honor.
Does the non-Jew have to agree to that situation?
No.
So what purpose does that even say? You always have the possibility of buying it back.
That's true, but the point is when you're verbalizing the stipulation, first of all, what does he have to? Meaning, if he has to agree to it, so you see, that's what we're going to get to. That's what we're going to get to in this discussion, right? That's part of that discussion of what is a matana gemura, a full-fledged sale or a full-fledged transfer of ownership. That's part of that discussion. But if we compel the non-Jew to agree to that stipulation, then the question is this really a sale, right? If we say to them, listen, I'll only sell it to you conditionally, you have to agree that if I want to buy it back, then I can buy it back, or you have to agree that I'm going to get it back after Pesach, then there's something wrong with that sale, and then the sale might not be valid, as we'll see.
But saying that, it has no bearing on it.
What do you mean?
I walk into a store today and say, you know, I'm going to buy that I might buy that TV tomorrow. And the salesman go, yeah, that's nice. Who cares?
Okay, so you're right. So you're right that in theory, there's not necessarily a lot of the line itself might not be legally binding. What I think is important about the line is that you can still. I think sort of what's innovative about this Tosefta is that you can verbalize the possibility that you leave open the option of buying it back. In other words, again, the idea is that before Pesach, the chametz is gone. You don't own it anymore. It's totally been transferred to that other person. And once you start sort of verbalizing the possibility or agreeing to the possibility that there may be a buyback afterwards, you're already starting to sort of, you know, allow some cracks to appear in the edifice of complete transfer of ownership. So even though he doesn't have to agree to it, again, as we'll see in a couple of minutes, whether he does or he doesn't or what exactly that means, the very fact that you're verbalizing the possibility is what starts making this whole sale seem sketchy. And that's why I think it's important. Yeah, John.
I think it's important to convince him to go forward with the sale than to convince him that he has to allow you to get it back. So if you say, I might buy it back from you, then he can say, oh, then maybe I don't have to worry about holding onto this, which I didn't really need, or something like that, rather than convincing him to give it back to you because you want it back.
Okay, yeah, and so that is a possibility. So in other words, you're making the sale, you're making it more palatable for him, but the main point is that you can't make it so palatable for him that he will know that he's not going to have his chametz when Pesach is over. Yes, Steve. Where we're sending the non-Jew this year. I said, guess where we're sending the person who bought the chametz this year.
don't have much whiskey. But, so that's my problem. Where is the real transaction?
Okay, so... So the intent is an important question, and it's going to be a lot of what we look at tonight kind of hinges on the question of intent. First of all, the Tosefta already addresses the question of intent directly. Those words, as long as he gives it as a full-fledged gift, is already addressing the question of intent, because it's already saying, don't give it to the non-Jew thinking that you're getting it back. Because if you give it thinking that you're getting it back, well, then there's something wrong with the sale. Right. In other words, according to halacha, certainly we always assume that if you sell something without really feeling like you're relinquishing ownership of that thing, then there's something wrong with the sale. The sale is flawed, and that's a lot of what we're going to be discussing here. Because if you rent your chametz to somebody else, you still remain the owner of the chametz, and then there was no point in doing that. Well, it might not be in your physical possession, but as long as you own the chametz, it's problematic. Just, you know, parenthetically, what is this all about? You know, I guess we should have addressed from the get-go that the whole idea is, right, that the Jew is not allowed to own chametz on Pesach, right? The Torah says, lo yera elachas, or you shall not see, or it shall not, no leavening shall be seen by you. And it says, "Sor lo yimatzeh b'batechem." No leavening shall be found in your homes. The rabbis, the rabbinic shorthand for that is "bal yera'eh u bal yimatzeh." Bal yera'eh u bal yimatzeh means shall not be seen, shall not be found, which is basically the idiom for the prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach. Which means whether it's in your house or not in your house, whether it's you know within your possession or not within your possession. That sounds like the formula that we say on Erev Pesach, right? It doesn't really matter. As long as you're the owner of the chametz, you're violating that Torah prohibition, bal yera'eh, bal yimatzeh. So renting it out, you're still the owner, even if it's not within your house.
In reality, that's what you're doing.
Well, in reality, that's the question. So let's move on. So we have to address, what are we doing in reality? Yeah, Jamie. Okay, we'll talk about that as we move along. Because, again, in theory they are. In theory, there's an outstanding, you know, they made a down payment and they now have an outstanding debt. There's a layaway plan, essentially. Right? So in theory, they are paying the fair market value for the chametz, just not right now. Just like if you bought, you know, furniture on layaway, you're paying the fair market value for the couch, you're just not paying it all at the time that you bring the couch at home. But let's go on. So let's talk about this line. What is Matana Gemura? What does it mean to give it as a full-fledged, bona fide gift? So, the third source on your page is from the time of the Gaonim. It's a book called the Bahag. The Bahag is one of the very important early formulations or sort of restatements of the halacha, of the practical halachot. And so it restates the Tosefta that we just said. It talks about a Jew and a non-Jew who are traveling on a boat before Pesach, and the Jew has chametz. He's allowed to sell it to the non-Jew, and he's allowed to subsequently purchase it back from him after Pesach. There, where the Tosefta uses the words, as long as it's a full-fledged gift, the Bahag, the author of the Halacha Kedolot, replaces that with three different words. The three different words are, Ubilvad Shelo Ya'arin. As long as there is no trickery involved here. Aha, so now the Bahag already starts throwing out at us this idea that you can't sell it if you think you're getting it back. Right now, the question is, what does Ya'arim mean? What exactly is the intention? Does it mean that you can't sell it to him, understanding fully well there's a possibility that you're going to get it back after Pesach? That's the way a lot of people understand the statement of the Bahag. In other words, the whole institution of the sale of chametz, as we practice it, he's basically discounting. Right? He's essentially saying, if you sell it with the knowledge that there's a good chance that you're going to get it back, you're engaging in harama, what we spoke about at the beginning of the first night, which basically means trickery, and that's something we're going to talk about a number of times tonight. If you're engaging in trickery, then it's a problem, and this is not a valid sale. But not everybody agrees that that's the correct interpretation of the Tosefta, of those lines, Shiitna Lov Matana Gemur, that it has to be a full-fledged sale. I'll give you another source. It's the 1, 2, 3, 4th source on the page. Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, better known as the author of the Or Zeruah. The Or Zeruah being a very important work of Ashkenazi halacha, a restatement and a sort of summary of relevant halachot, where he quotes this halacha, he quotes this Tosefta, he talks about the Jew and the non-Jew who are traveling together on a boat, and the Jew owns the chametz, he could sell it to the non-Jew, give it to him as a gift, purchase it back after Pesach. Again, he quotes what sounds like the Bahag Bavach, Lo Ya'arim. There can't be any trickery involved. You give it as a full-fledged gift, or you sell it as a full-fledged sale. Now, what does it mean you give it as a full-fledged gift, or you sell it as a full-fledged sale? What we're going to see as we go along is that there are two basically schools of thought in this approach to this Tosefta. One school of thought is represented by the Bahag that we saw before, who seems to say no trickery is involved. If you sell it thinking you're going to get it back, your sale is undermined. The other school of thought says, what does it mean to give it or to sell it as a full-fledged sale, a full-fledged transfer of ownership? It means, as basically Arnie, in response to your question before, that there can't be a condition stipulated at the time of the sale. Meaning you can't say, I will sell this to you on the condition that when the holiday is over, you sell it back to me. Because once you build that condition into the sale, you're essentially saying that this is not a full-fledged sale. You're saying this is not a bona fide sale, the sale is not complete, there's no real transfer of ownership, because I know for sure that I'm getting it back, because if I don't get it back, then the sale wasn't valid in the first place, right? That's the way a condition works. So the matana gemura, the full-fledged transfer of ownership, according to this other school of thought, means that there's no conditions attached to the sale. So even if there's some trickery involved, even if I know that there's a good chance that I can buy it back after Pesach, and I sell it knowing fully well that I may buy it back after Pesach, that's okay, as long as I didn't stipulate that the sale is conditional upon my buying it back after Pesach, right? That's very, very important. In fact, but again, this idea of there not being trickery involved, if you look at the fifth source of the page, there's a Ritva. Ritva, we keep looking at his sources from Ritva, and I think we've seen one in every one of our discussions. This is Rabbi Yom Tov of Seville, who was medieval in Spain, and he said, he even adds, right, Bavach lo Ya'arim, you're not allowed to engage in trickery. And he says, if you do engage in trickery regularly, if every year you sell chametz to a non-Jew before Pesach, and then somehow miraculously after Pesach you make it back to the house of the non-Jew to get your chametz back, he says, kansinanle, we penalize you and we don't let you keep that chametz. So the way that we do the sale of chametz, Ritva would not approve at all. He says, if every year you sort of have this routine, I'm going to sell it to you and then I'm going to buy it back afterwards, that's bad. That's harama. That's trickery, and that's not acceptable. What is acceptable? Full-fledged sale. Again, Beit Yosef, he disagrees with the Ritva, and he says, Beit Yosef is Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. So, in addition to the Shulchan Aruch, which is sort of his concise statement, his concise code of Jewish law, before he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote a very lengthy commentary, halachic commentary, where he shows the sources and the discussions and all of the backdrop of every practical halacha, at least the practical halacha that are still in effect today, and it's called the Beit Yosef. It's considered by most scholars to be his major work. In other words, even though the Shulchan Aruch is his most popular work and his best known work, the Beit Yosef is really his magnum opus. And when you study halacha and the yeshiva, when you're trying to get smicha or whatever, you always study Beit Yosef before you get to the Shulchan Aruch, because you want to see the source of where the Shulchan Aruch comes from. So, in the Beit Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, again, we're now already in the early modern period, or the very, very end of the medieval period, so he says he doesn't agree with this whole idea of Shelo Ya'arim. He doesn't think that trickery is a problem when it comes to the sale of chametz. He says, I'm just going to read this through quickly here. Rabbeinu Yerucham katav al Tosefta Zu. Rabbeinu Yerucham, one of the earlier commentaries, commenting on this Tosefta, he quotes the Bahag that we said before, that there cannot be any trickery involved. And he says, V'eini mevin dvarav. I don't understand why he says there cannot be any trickery involved. He says, Hashari litno l'gay b'matana. You're allowed to give the chametz to a non-Jew as a gift. V'lachzor v'lil kacho achar pesach. And you're allowed to then go back and buy it back from that non-Jew when Pesach is over. V'ein l'cha harama gedola mizu. There's no greater trickery than that, than knowing that the transfer of the ownership of the chametz was essentially temporary. V'afilu hachi sharia, and even so, it's okay, it's acceptable. So the author of the Shulchan Aruch says, if you sell the chametz, knowing that you will probably buy it back when Pesach is over, but not stipulating that the sale is conditional, then the sale is valid. The non-Jew owns the chametz, you don't own the chametz, and again, he says very clearly that it's just talking about not building any conditions into the sale, but if you know in advance you're going to buy it back, still okay, still an acceptable sale. So the way that we do it, in other words, the Shulchan Aruch would back up. He would support, I shouldn't say the way that we do it. He would support sort of the building block, the foundation of how we do it, which means to sell it knowing pretty well that we're going to be getting it back after Pesach, as long as during the time of Pesach there's no doubt that the chametz has been fully transferred to the non-Jew. Again, like we keep saying, to the extent that the non-Jew can come take it however they want. We're going to see that in the Chasam Sofer in a second. Yes, John. No, they're not distinguishing. They're conflating them, actually. Because according to Halacha, a sale and a gift have the same basic status. Either way, I am removing something from my possession and I'm transferring it into the possession of somebody else. And according to Halacha, you acquire a gift more or less the same way you acquire a sale. In other words, if I buy a cow, or if you give me a cow as a gift, either way, I have to go through the same process in order for me to own that cow, or whatever the modern equivalent of a cow. I don't know what the modern equivalent of a cow is. I guess a cow. So, what do you say? A car. Anyhow. But the point is, exactly. It's talking about, yes. It's talking about either giving it and then taking it, or selling it and then buying it, but it's really, the word is more acquisition than purchase or gift or whatever. That's what I'm saying. They're sort of conflating those concepts, because it really is basically one and the same concept. Now, I just want to show you like how far the Chasam Sofer goes with this, because the Chasam Sofer, we're going to see, deals a lot with the question of whether this is a real sale or not, whether it's okay to do it in this way that seems to be tricking. In the Chasam Sofer already, we're talking about, 19th century, he's well into what we would call the modern period, and he's really one of the architects of, with a lowercase m, modern orthodoxy, not with an uppercase m, but of sort of orthodoxy as it evolves in the modern world. And the Chasam Sofer says, listen, I'm going to tell you this is a bona fide sale, the way that we do it, and by his time already, we're not taking the chametz out of our houses, we're keeping the chametz in our houses, and we're still selling it to the non-Jew. Listen to what he says. It's kavanato mevu'ar. He says, the intention of the Beis Yosef is clear, that even though there's trickery involved, the ha'aramat mechira zu, using a trick for the sale of chametz, is absolutely absolutely permitted by the Torah without any hesitation. He's very, very clear here, and he's very, very explicit. I'm just going to read it in Hebrew, just so you get a sense for the flavor of the language. The Haramat Mechirazu he heter gamur min haTorah b'li shum pikpuk. This trick is absolutely permitted by the Torah without any hesitation whatsoever. It's a complete sale. You have to go through the process of sale. In other words, whatever process it is that we would use according to halacha to transfer ownership from a Jew to a non-Jew, you have to go through those processes, right? And he says, even though both parties, the Jew and the non-Jew, are fully aware of what's happening here. We're fully aware of the fact that when the Pesach is over, I'm going to come knocking on the non-Jew's door and say, hey, would you mind if I bought all that chametz back from you? Even if we know that a priori, at the time of the sale, he says, doesn't matter. In any case, at this moment, at the time of the transaction, it is, and when Pesach begins, it is completely sold. And that means, he says, I'm going to read this to you in Hebrew again so you get a sense of the flavor of the language. V'yachol halokeach l'machro, ula achlo, ula hakdisho, ula ha'avido mibli mocheh. I'm going to translate that. He says, the person who bought it can sell it, he can eat it, he can sanctify it, in other words, give it to the Beis HaMikdash if he wants, which, you know, not as easy to do right now. La'avido, he could destroy it if he wants. He wants to just flush it all down. He could do that. B'limochet, nobody is allowed to prevent him from doing so, right? But, the Chasam Sofer says, but he's not going to do that. Elishu ohavo, but the non-Jew is your friend, so he's not going to do that. And he's going to hold on to the chametz until the conclusion of Pesach, and then he's going to sell it back to you. And the sale that he does is also a full-fledged, bona fide sale without any hesitation whatsoever, without anybody undermining that sale, but during the days of Pesach, the chametz remains fully in the possession of the non-Jew. And by the way, he says, you're even allowed to say to him before Pesach, if you have the chametz after Pesach, I will almost certainly, karov levadai, I will almost certainly buy it back from you at an equal price. Then he connects it to the idea of harama, of halachic trickery. So he's very, very vociferous in terms of his defense of the sale of chametz. He says, as long as we go through the correct processes, it's a valid sale. Yeah. Good question. So, first of all, you should just know, because you don't sell your chametz, you should move into your own house. And then sell your own chametz, and then you'll see that we actually say on the sale of chametz contracts, you have to tell us where your key is going to be. How will somebody have access to your house on Pesach if they need to? So we ask for it. So you're right. Again, is it likely? Not likely. But it doesn't matter. As long as, this is what the Chasam Sofer is saying, as long as you go through the right processes, you're okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I know, yes.
Right, so does he expound on the thought process?
Well, it's a very long, it's a long tshuva, and we'll look at some more Chasam Sofer later on. But yeah, so we'll see some more of what he says as we proceed. I think, do I have more from him in here? I do, yes. We'll see a little more. Yeah, John.
There are some potential food issues when a non-Jew owns them. And they're like
mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you say that. So one of the interesting things, I'll tell you this. Let's put aside food issues for a second. Look, partially, sorry. So Pat Yisrael only has to do with the baking process. So as long as it's baked by a Jew, it doesn't matter if a non-Jew owned it. There's issues of basar shen aleim and ayin, meat that you lost sight of. But again, certainly in those days, that you weren't selling any meat. And now you don't have to sell any meat anyway, right? So okay, meat's out of the question. You know what big question comes up that I always go through this with people every year? Your plates, exactly, or your pots. Do you sell your utensils, right? Because what happens if you sell your utensils? After Pesach, you buy your utensils back from the non-Jew. What happens when a Jew buys their pots from a non-Jew? It's got to go back to the mikvah, exactly. So we always say don't sell your pots. But the very fact that that's something that we have to talk about shows that we really believe this is a real sale, right? If we didn't believe this was a real sale, we would say, go ahead, sell your pots. It doesn't matter. They're not really buying it anyway. But from the fact that we say don't sell your pots, because if you do, they all have to go to the mikvah, that's because we really believe in the validity and the legitimacy of the sale. That's a very, very important point. Now, I just want to show you one thing, though. The question is, where does all this come from? Why is it that we've gotten to this point that we sell the chametz without removing it from our house? Right. This is stage 3 and 4 of Rabbi Zevin's sort of historical sketch of the evolution of the sale of chametz. That's the last source on your first page. It's from a source called the Bach. The Bach is another very, very important sort of early modern or sort of transitional period commentary on the Torah and halachic source that is very, very foundational and fundamental for halacha as it's evolved since the 17th century. And the Bach explains to us why is the sale of chametz so important in the way that we practice it. This is where we see where halacha and history converge. Listen to what he says. In our country, Medina Zu, he's talking about Poland, where the Sherov Masal Matan, where the majority of business that Jews conduct is Biyayin Saraf. Yayin Saraf, well, if we translate those words literally, it means burning wine. Burning wine means? Sorry? No, it means whiskey. The majority of business that we do is with whiskey, and you can sell that to a non-Jew outside of your house. Specifically, I'm going to just continue with his source, then we're going to unpack this. Specifically, those who hold an arenda, he says we have to come up with a device to allow the sale of chametz without removing chametz from our home. He says, here's the permission, sell the chametz to the non-Jew and somehow transfer the space in which the chametz is located to the non-Jew as well. What on earth is he talking about? That the majority of our business has to do with whiskey? What does it mean to hold the arenda? This is the important reason for the evolution of the sale of chametz. This is how we got to the point that we're at today of the sale of chametz. So you have to go back to early modern Poland. And really, early modern Poland, we're talking about you can even trace this back to the 14th, 15th century, but into the 19th century, this basically remained the case. How did Jews make a living in Poland? In fact, why did Jews go to Poland in the first place? You wouldn't think, what we know about Poland now, it doesn't sound like, such an enticing place for Jews to go. But in fact, Jews were very much attracted to go to Poland because Poland was a place where Jews were able to make a fortune. How were they able to make a fortune? So there was a system that was called the arenda. The arenda was basically a lease that the Jews received, or somebody could receive, from a landlord, from a nobleman who owned land, and the nobleman would lease out his land or part of his businesses for a certain purpose. For example, a nobleman owned a field, and he didn't feel like farming that field. So what would he do? He would lease the field out to somebody, often a Jew, and that person would work the land, pay a portion of the profits to the nobleman, and keep the rest. Right? That's essentially like, leasing the land. Not like sharecropping. They weren't like slaves or like indentured servants or like peasants who had to work the land. The Jews, this was business, right? The Jews would pay for the right to work the land, and they would get to keep a certain portion of the profits. So there were a lot of these sort of privileges that the Jews would lease from the Polish nobility. And sort of in parentheses, it often didn't make for great relationships between the Jews and their non-Jewish neighbors. One of the examples of things that the Jews would lease from the Polish nobility was the right to collect taxes. They would pay, and again, the nobles, they either didn't have the patience for this, or they didn't have the ability to do it, or they didn't have the seichel, I don't know exactly what it is, but the nobles didn't want to collect taxes from their villages, from their peasants, mostly Polish non-Jews. And so a Jew would pay for the right to do it. He would give a portion of the taxes to the nobleman, and he would keep the rest for himself. And that's how a lot of Jews made a lot of money. That's how a lot of non-Jews, by the way, came to resent the Jews in a very, very big way in Poland. One of the rights that the Jews leased, and this was a Jewish lease, this was sort of almost like exclusively in the hands of the Jews for, again, centuries, was the right to produce and to sell alcoholic beverages. This is reflected in Polish writings, in Polish culture, in like Polish art. The idea that Jews owned the taverns in Poland, in some areas of Poland, when we talk about like at some point in history, the majority of the Jews were involved in making vodka or beer and selling it. There are people who have done research on this. So like, we'll look at a map of Poland divided into different regions, and they'll tell you, I'm giving you actual numbers here. In this region of Poland, 55% of the Jews made their living selling alcoholic beverages. In this section of Poland, 80% of the Jews made their living selling alcohol. And all the taverns were owned by Jews. I remember when I was a kid, we always used to hear these, you know, Hasidic stories about, like, you know, the Baal Shem Tov was traveling and he went to a tavern and, you know, the Jewish tavern owner fed him and gave him whiskey, whatever. And I always used to wonder when I was a kid, like, these stories have to be made up, right? Because how do they keep coming across Jewish tavern owners? How many Jews actually own taverns, right? Well, it turns out, all of them. All of the taverns, more or less, were owned by Jews, historically speaking. They had the right to do that because they would purchase that right from the, again, from whoever the landlord was, whoever the nobleman was. That was called the arenda. And here's what happens. If your job is to be the wholesaler, the distributor of vodka to the entire region, or if your job is to be a tavern owner, an innkeeper, essentially, and your job is to keep the alcohol flowing for people on a nightly basis, there's a good chance that you have a pretty decent supply of vodka or beer in your back room. If you have a decent supply of alcohol or beer in your back room on Erev Pesach, you're not going to start rolling out the kegs and sell them to your non-Jewish neighbor because that's an impossibility. There's just too much there for you to sell. Well, that's where we come up with our new system of the sale of chametz as a formality. That's what the Bach, this last source on the first page, is talking about. What he's saying is, we have too much chametz to sell to be able to remove it from our houses. So this old model of just, you know, taking your box of rolls or your box of, you know, with a few bottles of whiskey and bringing it to your non-Jewish neighbor and either, you know, selling it completely or coming up with one of these ha'arama, one of these sort of, you know, sales where you kind of know what's going to happen or it's not going to happen, that's not going to work anymore because we've got too much of that stuff. So instead they come up with a sale that's a formality. We conclude the sale between us, we make a deal, we sign a contract, we go through a process, a number of different kinyanim, a number of different sort of processes of acquisition, but the chametz stays put. It's not going anywhere. Now, I might rent you the space and say, okay, for the duration of Pesach, you own that room, or you've rented that room, or whatever it is, there might be all kinds of things, but the reality of the arenda, the economic reality of the Jewish people, didn't allow the chametz to be sold the way it once was. And this is, you know, sort of coming back to the way we spoke last week about Hillel, which said tikkun olam, that the entire economic system could have collapsed if Hillel didn't allow people to get their debts repaid when the Shemitah year came. Well, here we're talking about another, again, a very, very similar thing. If the Jews would have completely relinquished ownership of all of the beer and vodka in Poland, which is basically what that meant, we're talking about the Jewish economy collapsing. In parentheses, we might be talking about the Polish economy collapsing more broadly because there's a reason that the landlords chose the Jews to be specifically the distributors of the beverages. Let's put it that way. There was a sense, if you look in the history books, that they felt that the Jews could be trusted to, let's say, not drink the profits. Okay, let's put it that way, which their non-Jewish counterparts would not necessarily be as trustworthy in that regard. So not only would the Jewish economy collapse, there's a good chance that all hell would have broken loose if you wouldn't have let it happen. So that's the backdrop of the sale of chametz as we have it today. But what I want to show you now is don't think that this was without its objections. There are a few major objections to this because once we start talking about a sale as a formality in which there's no actual transfer of merchandise, you have to imagine that people are going to start questioning this. So there are a few objections that I'm going to show you. Now here we're moving away from Rabbi Zevin's structure because here we're working on a more sort of conceptual. I just want to show you. So we're not going in historical order at all. We're going kind of back and forth. We're going to be ricocheting back and forth historically just so we could see the types of objections that people had towards this sale. So objection number one. This is on the second page. Objection number one, another excerpt from the Chasam Sofer, is he quotes a rabbi who had the following problem. When you had contracts, both today, but if you think about, you know, think about your American history, the Stamp Act, right? This idea that, like, you always have to pay a fee in order to get contracts or certain things, every document had to have some sort of fee or tax affixed to it, or you had to pay a notary to validate this contract. Well, that's not a modern idea. I mean, well, it's a modern idea. It's not necessarily a brand new idea. So also in the 17th and the 18th centuries, if you had a contract, you had to get your contract officially notarized by some official government representative, and you had to pay a fee in order for your contract to be notarized. Well, what happens? In some town in Europe, they make the contract up. They conclude the contract with a non-Jew. They take it to the judge or whoever it is to get him to notarize the contract and to fix his stamp to the contract. And the non-Jew says, I don't need to fix my stamp to this. This is just some religious issue. It doesn't really matter. And you know, sounds like everybody's going to be happy, right? Because now you don't have to pay the taxes, except, you know, the rabbis with their need to find problems and everything. The alarm goes off in the head of the rabbi of the town, who says, wait a minute, if the government relates to this as just a religious matter and not as a business matter, then do I have a binding contract here or do I not have a binding contract here? And he sends that question off to the Chasam Sofer, because it sounds like, he says, this is not a binding contract. If the government won't put the seal on it, then this whole thing is fake. So again, not as relevant today, but it still kind of touches on sort of, you know, these big questions of, is this a real sale or is it not a real sale? And if people just relate to this, again, John, this might have been one of the, sort of related to the question that you were saying before, that if people relate to this, that was just some weird quirk of the Jewish religion, then the whole edifice might be false. Because if it's a weird quirk of the Jewish religion and not an actual binding contract, then the chametz wasn't actually sold, and then everybody's in very, very big trouble. So the question goes off to the Chasam Sofer, and the Chasam Sofer, again, re-emphasizes the point that we saw him make before, which is, no, don't worry, this is a real sale, this is a binding sale. If you really wanted to have a document that was enforceable in court, you really wanted to enforce this contract in court, he says, not only, it would certainly be enforceable in a Beit Din, first of all, he says, don't worry about that, it would certainly hold up in a Jewish court, and the sale would be definitely enforceable and legitimate in the Jewish court, but he says, I have a sense that even in a non-Jewish court, it would be enforceable. But, you know, the official who wouldn't put his stamp on it, that's because he sort of wants to be nice to the Jews, and he doesn't want the Jews to have to pay taxes for something which is really about religion. But if you went to him and you said, listen, we really want this to be a binding contract, he would certainly put his stamp on it, so don't worry about it, it's a standing and a binding sale. But the point that we keep getting to, the point that the Chasam Sofer is making is, it's got to be a binding sale. So some people raise the question, is this really a binding sale if people just relate to it as a quirk of the Jewish religion? So the answer is, it's got to be structured in a way that it's not just a quirk of the Jewish religion, and it really is something which is legitimate and enforceable. That's sort of objection number one. Objection number two goes to the way that we do things today. The way that we do it today is, again, we do it through an agent, right? Everybody comes to me and signs a contract, and then I represent us, and I represent the community, and I don't represent the community. I represent every individual in our negotiations and in the sale of the chametz. And the question is, to what extent is agency valid? This question comes from Rabbi Yosef Shaul Natanson, a book called Shaul Meshev. Rabbi Yosef Shaul Natanson was another one of these major rabbinic figures in the 19th century in Poland. Again, a name that's very well known within halachic texts, a little bit less well known for those who don't study halacha in depth. But when you see a person like that raising an objection to the sale of chametz as it's structured, then you know that this is a serious objection because it's coming from a very serious person. What's also interesting is that by the 19th century, when he's raising this objection, it's still not universal to sell the chametz through an agent. This idea that everybody kind of goes to the rabbi or goes to the Beit Din or goes to whoever and sells the chametz in that way, well, that was something which to him seemed like a newfangled innovation that he found problematic for a list of reasons. Among his list of reasons were that he felt that there's a question as to whether an agent is allowed to sign on a sale on behalf of the person that they're representing according to halacha, and he says, he raised the question, some of the questions that have been mentioned. For example, in the middle of the page, I don't want to read it to you because it's not so clear, it's in Rashi's script, and he says, you know, generally speaking, the person who's purchasing the chametz is not even familiar with the person who's selling the chametz. They just kind of, you know, have hearsay from the agent who comes to them and says, I want to sell all this chametz to you, everybody in the town. I'm selling the... sorry. I'm selling the chametz for everybody in the town and all of the businesses and everybody in the surrounding area. So he says, that sounds a little problematic. It sounds a little bit like, you know, who's really gonna get involved in a sale like that? And he says, you know, I don't even know if the down payment that is given is really a good down payment. We're going to see more about that in a second, right? And he talks about the fact that rabbis have been debating this for a long time, but at the end of the day, he says he does not like this idea. He doesn't like the fact that chametz is sold through an agency. By the way, he also adds another problem is that people didn't specify the kind of chametz that they sold. So that's what we take care of, right? We make you specify the kind of chametz that you sell. But really, what's, you know, the situation he's describing is kind of like probably the way things were, I mean, when I was a kid, and probably the way things were when people, you know, some of you might have seen chametz being sold when you were younger, which is the rabbi used to have this big contract that was written in Hebrew, and it had a lot of space in the bottom of the page, and you just go, and the rabbi would sort of like, you know, take it, and spend, oh, you're selling the chametz, okay, and write your name on the page, right? So now, you'd have a page, and some people still do this today, they kind of have like the big page, and on the bottom of the page, you just keep adding more and more names to the bottom of the page, so that the non-Jew gets presented with this sort of, you know, like, lengthy, looks like a petition, right? A lengthy list of names and addresses, and says you're going to get all this chametz. He's like, wait a minute. So he doesn't. The person who's buying the chametz has never seen the person who's selling the chametz. They don't know, you know, what they're all about, and there's no specification of the types of chametz or the value of the chametz. Instead, he says this does not really meet the bar. This doesn't meet the test of chametz. Instead, he says this is just. He says Akol Yodim She'eino Rak Ha'arama. This is all just a big trick. And if it's all just a big trick, then he thinks that it's not binding. That's objection number two, sale through an agent. Objection number three I gave you, which is on the, I guess, the last page, which basically says, you know what, this whole thing is fake. This comes from, again, we're bouncing back in history a little bit. Like I said, we've sort of abandoned the historical structure. We're looking now more to more conceptual structure. This comes from Rabbi Alexander Sender Shor, who wrote a book called Bechor Shor. Again, he was well known. He was a very well known rabbinic figure during his time, to the extent that the Chasam Sofer feels the need to engage with his approach, and a lot of people are going to feel the need to engage with his approach to the question. Now, I'll give you a little bit of backdrop to the question. The question that he's dealing with is not just the sale of chametz as we've been describing it, right, in which the tavern owners kind of, you know, take a deposit for their big storehouse full of beer and vodka, and hopefully they'll get the sale back, you know, the money back after Pesach. But he's talking about another situation in which Jews owned animals, and the animals ate grains, and over Pesach, a lot of the animals would get skinny. They would go for a week eating only hay, and they wouldn't look so good when Pesach was over, and it would take a few weeks for the animals to fatten up again and to go back to their to their original value, which could entail a loss of money. Well, somebody comes up with a great idea. Listen, if we're already selling the chametz, why not sell all the cows also? So they would sell all the cows to the non-Jews also, and the Bechor Shor, interestingly, talking about animals, and his name is Shor, in parentheses, says, you know what, this whole thing doesn't work. Listen to what he says. He says, you know what, he says, Pirchal Mechiras Chametz. He says, you know, Mikar Dedina, Pirchal Mechiras Chametz. I have a big question about this whole sale of Chametz HaNahug, which the way that we practice this, which is, Hello, Mukham Bilsada Ha'arama Tuva. This is just a big trick. Why? Because who are we selling it to? Polish peasants? Which Polish peasant can afford all the cows in town? Give me a break, he says. You know, he says, we're selling these things. The peasants would never come to us to buy our entire herds. They can't afford it. So what are we doing, right? We're going to the poor person and we're saying, listen, you know, I have thousands and thousands of dollars worth of chametz. Give me a $15 down payment and it's all yours. Until after Pesach, when you have to pay me for the rest of it. Because of course, everybody knows this is not a legitimate sale. Of course, everybody knows that this is fake. And then he says, so why do we allow it at all? In other words, he's not saying rule it out, but he's saying, why do we allow it? So here's his important approach. And this is going to be a very important approach taken by a number of rabbis and controversial, as I'm going to show you in a minute. So he says, you know what? The truth is, we wouldn't allow it if what you were selling was actual chametz according to the Torah. But in truth, the chametz that we own is only problematic according to the rabbis. Why? Because according to the, if you look in the Talmud, it says that if you want to remove the chametz from your possession, there's a very easy way to do it. You don't have to sell it. You don't even have to burn it, technically. According to the, if you, on a Torah level, if you want to remove the chametz from your possession, all you have to do is recite that formula that's in the Haggadah that you say around the time that you burn the chametz, or around the time that you search for chametz. In Aramaic, it says, Kol chamira v'chamia de'ika v'rishuti. Any kind of chametz or any leavening that might be in my possession, if I've seen it or I haven't seen it, if I burned it or I haven't burned it, it should all be nullified. According to the Torah, once you say that, you don't own the chametz any longer. So that when we sell the chametz to the non-Jew, really all we're doing is selling chametz that we don't own according to the Torah, It's only chametz that we own according to rabbinic law. In other words, the rabbi's mandate, this is what the Gemara says, that we have to search for chametz and burn chametz and sell chametz, all of that is of rabbinic mandate, not of Torah mandate. So he says, you know why the trick works? The trick works because we're not trying to get out of a Torah prohibition, we're trying to get out of a rabbinic prohibition, because we don't really own that chametz according to the Torah, we only own it according to the rabbis, and therefore, the trick of selling chametz according to the Bechor Shor, Rabbi Alexander Shor, only works if it's rabbinic chametz, not if it's Torah chametz. Yes? Well, it's batel. It was gone, according to Pesach. Then after Pesach, when Pesach came up, after Pesach, you reacquired it. Either it miraculously came back into existence, it was nullified before, and now it's back in existence, or it was hefker before, right? It was ownerless before, and now you've reacquired ownership of it, depending on how, again, there's discussions that are shown about that. But either way, so, you know, it's re-entered your possession, midoraisa, after Pesach. And when you buy back with a non-Jew, again, it's only on a midrabanan. It's only on a rabbinic level that you no longer own the chametz. Now, this is a big, big deal because this changes the approach to the sale of chametz. Because what he's saying is, on a Torah level, can you employ these tricks? According to the Bechor Shor, Rabbi Alexander Shor, living in the 1700s in Poland, no. Tricks do not work if we're trying to get out of a Torah prohibition. And when he says that, I won't say that all hell breaks loose, but let's just say a lot of people go after him and say, not true, Rabbi, even on a Torah level, the trick of selling chametz works. The Chasam Sofer is one of the most vociferous defendants of that idea, that even on a Torah level, the sale of chametz works. And they say, listen, first of all, you know, the trick works even according to the Torah. Second of all, again, what we're doing here is not trickery. We're actually going through a real transaction. And like the Chasam Sofer said before, the chametz might be sitting in your house, but if the person who bought it wants to come to your house and take it, it's totally within their rights to do so. And so what we're saying here is this, that it's not trickery per se. It might look like it, might smell like it, but at the end of the day, and this is where intention comes in, at the end of the day, as long as you know that you have fully sold the chametz, even if you know that you're getting it back after Pesach, as long as you know that during Pesach, the sale is valid and legitimate, as long as you know that at the time of the sale there was never a condition built into the sale that said that it had to come back after Pesach, but at the time of the sale we stipulated that this sale is binding and legitimate, then the sale stands, even if you are fairly certain that when the holiday is over, all of the chametz is coming back into your possession. That's what the people who defend the institution of the sale of chametz say, in response to the Bechor Shor. But his position kind of sets off there's a whole approach now within halacha that says, when I say now, I mean, you know, from the 17th century and onward, that says don't sell real chametz. If you have any real chametz in your possession, if you have bread, or if you have cake, or if you have whiskey, or if you have that box of noodles, don't sell it. Only sell chametz that is considered chametz according to rabbinic law, which means, you know, things that have mixtures or whatever it might be, but don't sell any real, full-fledged, bona fide chametz. That's one approach, but another approach says, wait a minute. History. The whole institution of selling chametz, where did it come from? It came from those taverns? It came from those Jews who owned whiskey? What do you think they're selling? The Rabbi Eider, Rabbi Shimon Eider, who wrote a lot of English books on halacha. He was a great student of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he wrote a lot of very important English works of halacha. So he often has, in his footnotes, discussions that he had with Rav Moshe Feinstein. So he says, he asked Rav Moshe, can you sell real chametz? Or can you only sell chametz that's prohibited according to the rabbis? And he has a footnote, Rav Moshe said to him in Yiddish, if you're not selling real chametz, what do you think you're selling? In other words, Rav Moshe was pretty clear, you could sell the real deal. And that's what we rely on in our community. Apparently Rav Soloveitchik was not as thrilled with the idea of selling full-fledged real chametz, but here's what we're getting at. What we're getting at is the sale of chametz a trick? The answer is, it kind of looks like one, and it kind of resembles one, but as long as the intention is to work within the system, this is what we keep emphasizing in each and every lesson, as long as the intention is that what we're doing is something real and legitimate, even if it looks fishy and it looks funny and it doesn't look so legitimate, it still stands, and it still has that legitimacy. I added a little story here, at the sort of as a conclusion, that Rabbi Jachter put in one of the issues of Kol Torah. So he talks about Rabbi Adler, says that he once heard Rav Soloveitchik talk about a visit to Brisk. It's in English, so we can read it in the actual source. He visited his grandfather in Brisk before Pesach, and he attended the sale of chametz that was conducted by the famed Dayan of Brisk, Rabbi Simcha Zelig Rieger. One individual, recalls the Rav, began to ridicule the sale of chametz, whereupon Rav Simcha Zelig threw the individual out of the room. When the Rav related the incident to his grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was the rabbi of Brisk, Rav Chaim applauded Rav Simcha Zelig's actions. Rav Chaim asserted that just as Rabbeinu Tam issued a ban on anyone who casts frivolous doubts on the validity of an executed get, so too it is forbidden to ridicule the accepted practices of Am Yisrael. In other words, what he's getting at is this. All those people who every year kind of say, come on, is this a real sale? The answer to those people is yes, it is. It really is. It's a full-fledged, bona fide, real sale. And so Rav Chaim says, you're not allowed to laugh at it, you're not allowed to ridicule it, but what that means is, you're not allowed to undermine it, you're not allowed to undermine the validity of it, because even though it would appear to be that we're employing some sort of trickery here, in actuality, what we're doing is building an edifice that has the legal standing to actually be effective and to actually be valid and to actually be legitimate. Having said that, it is important to understand that throughout the ages there have been people who did find the practice questionable and who found certain elements of it to be questionable and to be, you know, illegitimate, and to see that there were some cracks in the system. So that's what I wanted to show you in this system. In this discussion tonight. That we do practice it and we do sell the chametz, but understand that it evolved, first of all, from the sale of chametz from small quantities where the property was actually being transferred to the way that we do it today. Number one, just understand the evolution. Number two, understand the reasoning for the evolution, which is, like so many things that we've seen, that the change happened because if we hadn't done it in this way, there would have been a major economic calamity. That's point number two. And point number three is to understand that as long as we maintain fidelity to the system and to the rules of the system, that's when those tricks can stand, and that's when those tricks work. And it's never a question of stepping out of the system and of somehow circumventing or violating or contravening the system, but always working within the system. Yeah, Seymour, you had a question?
Is chametz chametz meaning?
Yes, it is.
Meaning that the author with the sale of the chametz, where I thought advised to get rid of the cereals, the bread that may be frozen in the freezer, maybe some
So again, what we're saying here is that it sounds like that stuff can be sold. Right, that seems to be Rav Moshe's conclusion, the Chassam Sofer. A lot of people seem to arrive at that conclusion. Let's have for tonight.